I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Mr. Pop.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
67 years ago,
when in the course of human events,
and so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
The United States presidential election of 1800 was the fourth time Americans had gone to the polls to elect their head of state. It was held from Friday, October 31st to Wednesday, December the 3rd. It is sometimes referred to as the Revolution of 1800. The election saw Vice President Thomas Jefferson defeat President John Adams. It was a realigning election. It ushered in a generation of Democratic-Republican Party rule and the eventual demise of the Federalist Party. Today, I'm joined by Adam Vanami and Matt Martin to discuss this most peaceful transfer of power and the most rancorous of elections. Hello, gentlemen. How are we?
Good. How you doing?
Hello. Great here.
We're calling this a peaceful transfer of power?
Well, it was, wasn't it? There was no call to arms.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Set the precedent.
If that's our barometer, I guess that's what we'll go off of.
Adam, could you tell us about the America of 1800?
So the America of 1800 was very agrarian. It was a lot of farming lifestyle. This is very much pre-industrial revolution. The move to the cities haven't happened yet. The best way I heard it described was it was more akin to Rome 1,000 years ago than even America 50 years later when the railroad boom happens. The Romans had more infrastructure in place as far as paved roads had back then. And most Americans never really even left their county or their town. So it was very much focused on farming your goods and getting them to market.
You know, additionally, in the 24 years since independence was declared, the population had exponentially grown. In fact, the average birth per female was 7 live births per female in America at that time.
I don't want to think about the logistics of that, but that's a lot of population boom.
Yep, there was a lot of joy going around.
Yeah, I guess so.
In the new nation.
Yeah.
And obviously at that point, America had just kind of come through the quasi-war. Could you describe its relations with France and with Britain?
I guess we'll take Britain first. So today we look at Britain as having a special relationship. And after the Revolutionary War, we had this hangover of kind of everything British was bad and everything the Federalists kind of clinged to as wanting to have a centralized, stable government was labeled as British unfairly. You know, Hamilton wanting to have a centralized bank, anything as far as infrastructure funded by the government. everything as far as wanting to have a navy, a standing army, was labeled as British. And that was pretty much the first, that was our relations with the British, but we were trying to normalize things a bit there. Now, the French Revolution has happened by this point, and it was bloody. The Democrat Republicans had looked at this as an extension of our revolution, akin to the way maybe that the Soviets did in 1918, where they looked at the Bolshevik Revolution as a world revolution. And Jefferson, Madison, these guys looked at it as our duty to support France in their revolution. And their revolution turned very bloody. And in kind of France's defense, the quasi-war started because we decided that since the monarchy was gone, we didn't need to pay our loans back to France.
The Evening Mail, 19 September 1798, Wednesday. It is ever pleasing to have occasion to remark on the prompt readiness of our fellow citizens to contribute to the support of measures of defense. In no instance has a greater degree of this spirit shown itself than assisting at the fortifications now almost completed on the Battery, where the labor of all ranks has been in daily exercise, from 40 to 70 a day. The Americans begin to know their resources, strength, and importance, and to display a proper spirit. They had so long been treated with contempt and contumely that they even began to think meanly of themselves. But the multiplied, barefaced atrocities of the French, together with the representations and indignant exhortations of our eagle-eyed and undaunted Adams, have at length roused the sleeping energies of our countrymen. About $1 million of dollars have been voted for fortifying harbors and purchasing cannon, small arms, ammunition, and military stores. 13,000 men have been raised as a regular standing army during the present dispute with France. If actual hostilities commence, 10,000 are to be added, and besides these, 80,000 militia are ordered to be ready at a moment's warning. Nor have we been less spirited in naval exertions. When the armament now ordered is complete, we shall have at sea 9 large frigates, 12 sloops of war, from 20 to 24 guns, 6 from 16 to 18, about 10 cutters, and as many galleys, making in all 48 ships of war. No inconsiderable force for the first effort of a nation, which 3 months ago had not an armed vessel afloat. To this account may be added a stout frigate or two from 9 or 10 states as a voluntary loan to government. When we look at this, and then turn our eye to the astonishing unanimity and zeal exhibited in favor of governance, we may view with contempt the threats of the terrible Republic.
So you've introduced Jefferson and Hamilton. Why don't you introduce all the main players in the election of 1800 and then also describe the breakdown of the two political parties?
Our Constitution very naively did not reflect or account for political parties. And the Founding Fathers had a high-minded ideal that men should be above party and that there should be no factionalism. Everyone should consider an issue on its merits and proceed accordingly. And again, this is incredibly naive, but the most naive person out of this whole thing was George Washington. And he basically kept his cabinet together. I had Jefferson on one side, Hamilton on the other, and Adams as vice president. And he wanted to really keep the petty factionalism aside and even warned against it in his retirement speech. But by this point, Adams was not officially a Federalist in 1796 when he was elected. However, he's very much a centrist, and him and Jefferson have started breaking. So there's been a lot of dinner parties and a lot of attempts at collaboration between the two camps. But by this point, it's been pretty recognized that they can't really see eye to eye and have this idealistic vision of Founding Fathers, and that really kind of the creation of the political parties really caused issues from that perspective. So the first one is the most obvious, which is the sitting president, John Adams. He's the second president of the United States, a fascinating character. We could do a whole podcast on just his life prior to being a president. He had been the first ambassador to Britain. He was an envoy in France two times. He had gone to the Dutch to try to secure key loans during the revolution and traveled back and forth to Philadelphia and New York, you know, many, many times. I think he's probably the most well-traveled American at the time. So anyway, John Adams is very much, he's kind of a stubborn old goat, I guess, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. He prior to being the president, he was the vice president, which was the worst possible job for him. For a guy who was a great orator and loved to talk, he basically had to sit and just point to people and tell them when it's their turn to talk when he provides. So for those of us who don't know what the vice president does, is they're the president pro tem. So they preside over the Senate, which means you're just sitting there and your real role is to tell people when to talk. And your only real role is if you're a tie-breaking vote. So Adams basically had to sit through 4 years of just sitting and watching other people talk, which must have been terrible. So he's had some issues. So he made a blunder of keeping Washington's cabinet, which he thought was a unifying thing, but he had some real people who did not see eye to eye with him. You mentioned the Quasi War. There was a lot of pressure from Hamilton to have a standing army. And that, again, you have to put yourself back in the time, was looked at as tyranny. You're dealing with an America that has had to quarter troops against their will. And this is looked at as tyranny of the masses. And there's very much this idealistic, egalitarian, romanticism, farmer lifestyle America that the Democrat Republicans want. And then you have Hamilton on the other side, who, although he's kind of a jerk, he understands what the realities of needing to be able to fight a war against France if need be. The most controversial thing that happens to Adams is the Aliens and Sedition Acts.
The president is hereby empowered to designate as alien enemies any citizens or subjects of hostile nations residing in the United States whose presence he regards as dangerous, and make regulations for their apprehension, restraint, or removal. It shall be a crime to utter or publish writings against the government of the United States with intent to defame or bring it into contempt or disrepute.
So because of officially, I'm doing my air quotes for Woodfield, because of the Quasi War, we pass the Alien and Sedition Acts, which basically allows to do two things. One of which is basically unilaterally deport any foreigner that we deem to be dangerous. Now
this, you know, Adam, just to play on that, you know, mm-hmm. where this tension was created was, you know, Thomas Jefferson was a Republican, mm-hmm. you know, pro-French. He was a minister in France. Mm-hmm. And this Alien and Sedition Act, was really intended, I don't know if it was necessarily intended, but it was really used against French foreigners mm-hmm. in the country.
Well, do you know who Citizen Genet was? So early in Washington's term, right after the French Revolution really takes off. So the French Revolution happens early in Washington's mm-hmm. term. And Citizen Genet was a Frenchman who was the ambassador to the United States, and instead of going straight to Washington and presenting himself, lands in South Carolina, has parades. He has all kinds of people, you know, basically throwing him ticker tape parades, and starts basically trying to recruit American citizens to serve in the Revolutionary French Marine. So France is looked at as kind of a rabble rouser. This guy was just very blatantly disrespectful. So there's that kind of pressure as far as that, but that's bad enough. But the one of our First Amendment rights, freedom of speech. Basically, we can decide that if President Adams doesn't like what someone's saying, he can jail them. And there's just nothing good about this. I mean, from a modern perspective, I mean, you have to put yourself back in the time. And looking back on it, we know it as a blunder now. But the real reasons that a lot of people think that this happened is even worse. Because if we think the press is bad today, back then it was horrible. But they just said the most god-awful things about each other. And there was a gentleman by the name of James Callender, who was kind of, later we would call him, yellow journalist, but he would just make up anything possible. And they would slander their opponents. And the Republican rags, James Callender ran one of these and criticized the Adams presidency. And at Jefferson's request, he published an anti-federalist paper called The Prospect Before Us, where he talks about Adams' tyranny and just how, you know, all these kind of hysterical names, but at the time were really insulting. And at this point, Adams has just had it. And basically this law was crafted to go after guys like this. And they prosecute Callender. And they exclude the vice president. This is how base and open this act was.
Right. I mean, when it was passed and after it was passed, basically everyone tried were Republicans. Mm-hmm. You know, so the law alone, many of the people in his cabinet felt it was tyrannical. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes against what our Constitution had declared as the Bill of Rights.
I don't know if I agree with that. So his cabinet members, I think Adams' biggest problem was his cabinet members. And he kept a lot of his old, a lot of Washington's old cabinet members, like mm-hmm. Pickering and those guys like that. They gave him some pretty bad advice, and he had to dismiss some of them. I think if he had picked a better cabinet, he may have been steered differently on this.
When I say his cabinet, I'm more speaking about his vice president.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson, you know, who again is a strong Republican,
yeah,
and feels that this Alien and Sedition Act is going against the French.
Yeah, so this
and
was
Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is primarily pointed at James Callender, and they end up giving him a $200 fine and a 6-month prison sentence. But this Jefferson releasing Callender kind of comes home to roost against him, because he's actually the one who ends up breaking the Sally Hemings story later. And finally, before we move off on Callender, he's the one who effectively ruined Hamilton as a political candidate. So he was the one who exposed the Maria Reynolds affair. And Hamilton wasn't necessarily – he became the godfather of the Federalist Party, I kind of refer to it as. But he didn't want that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he still had political ambitions, but this pretty much deep-sixed him. From ever being able to publicly hold office. And so those are the pressures that really push this act over the edge.
So if we're looking at the end of the term of Adams as president, we have the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans basically fighting each other through the press. Would that be a fair way to sum things up? Because technically speaking, they're all part of the same government, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. It was dirty. I mean, if you followed our election, how dirty that was, this was even dirtier. I mean, there were, as Adam mentioned, there were these rags out there, numerous papers in every city. These rags, which were political, either they were a Federalist rag or a Republican rag, would publish these stories, these salacious stories about the candidates. I mean, there were some that went as far as to say that the candidate had died.
So I mentioned George Washington. He was unofficially a Federalist. By this point, I mean, Washington had seen, and if you want some good background on this, I'm not going to go into this. You should listen to the episode about George Washington, where he really sees the struggles of what happens when you don't have a strong centralized government. So he's become a Federalist by this point, and he's loved. Can't stand Jefferson by the end of his term. Delegated a lot of his authority to the next Federalist we'll talk about, which is Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury. He gets close to Washington during the Revolutionary War. He was his aide-de-camp, and he, towards the end of his Washington's presidency, starts getting more and more authority handed to him, and to the point where during Adams' presidency, he basically gets made the commander of the army. And Adams is in the position where he can thumb his nose at Washington, which he can't do even in retirement, mm-hmm. and has to deal with Hamilton.
You know, an interesting point on Hamilton, I read an article about Hamilton in George Washington's cabinet, mm-hmm. and you know, they are Federalists, right? Mm-hmm. They're pro-English. Really, the way it was set up was George Washington was the figurehead, you mm-hmm. know, the monarchy, the,
yeah.
you know, and Alexander Hamilton really took on the role as the PM,
the William Pitt and, right. and King George.
Right. Type I mean, of
dynamic.
He chose which office he had.
Yeah.
You know, he helped decide which what those offices were going to be mm-hmm. that were going to create the government.
Yeah.
So I mean, he really was the father of.
Yeah. I mean, it's
the Federalist
I
approach.
Mean, if he wasn't so cantankerous, he might have gotten somewhere. But he does have a musical named after him.
It's a great musical.
Moving and one of the best insults I've ever heard was Adams called him the bastard son of a Scotch peddler. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try to figure out a way to throw that into my vernacular sometime soon. But so the last one, we'll get to this briefly, and we'll get into that. And this will play into the dynamics of the election as it plays out. Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. And he's a favorite son of Southern politicians.
Hartford Courant, Hartford, Connecticut, Monday, December 8th, 1800. Extract of a letter from Colonel Wade Hampton of South Carolina to Colonel Holmfin, Virginia, dated Columbia, November 11th, 1800.
The Federalists in Charleston have made extraordinary exertions lately in favor of General Pinckney and have turned their views to every part of the state. Major Butler and his colleagues, because they are Republicans, have by a maneuver been shut out. The change is not so alarming as to numbers, but I think there will be a want of nerve to resist the pretensions of General Pinckney. Mr. Jefferson will have every vote here, but there is great danger that General Pinckney will also.
We did have running mates, really. So there was. We'll get into the dynamics of the actual vote. But you had two votes for president. The Federalist plan, for lack of a better term, was Adams first, Pinckney second. Pinckney becomes kind of he really takes the high road. But there's two forces in this election. One is party, and one is region. And the Southerners start trying to use their second vote to maybe elevate Pinckney as a backstop. And Pinckney takes the high road and says, no, if you vote first, you're going to vote for Adams. And he becomes kind of a distraction. But those are our main Federalists.
So we've got the Republicans or the Democratic Republicans. Mm-hmm. At the time, they were known as the Republicans, but this is not the Republican Party we see today in America.
No.
So it is the Democratic Republic Party. We've got probably the leader of that, who is Thomas Jefferson, obviously one of the founding fathers. He really was the head of the Revolution. He was the embodiment of Enlightenment. He was from Virginia. He was heavily involved in writing the Articles of the Confederation and also the Constitution itself. So under Washington, he was the Secretary of State. Okay, so the next Democratic Republican that plays a part in this election is James Madison. I would say Alexander Hamilton is to federalism as James Madison is to republicanism. At this point, he's very Republican. Now, an interesting fact, as you mentioned about James Madison, is that 20 years earlier, he was a Federalist, and he wrote the Federalist Papers that really were the basis for the Constitution, which is, you know, a stronger central government.
Okay.
But at this point, James Madison is buddy-buddy with Tom Jefferson, and really believed that government was only needed for liberty and security. So he was strongly in the Republican camp. Additionally, there is James Monroe, who is another politician, founding father from Virginia. He has a similar background to Thomas Jefferson. He was also the Minister of France and the Governor of Virginia. And an interesting fact about Monroe is when Monroe was the Minister of France, it was in George Washington's cabinet, and George Washington called him back from France because he couldn't convince the French that the Jay Treaty was good for the French, even though it was not good for the French.
I can't argue that.
Right.
Yeah.
So he had bad feelings towards George Washington, obviously Alexander Hamilton, and the Federalists. So Tom Jefferson and James Madison and James Monroe really are the Republican founding fathers. And after 1800, they all become presidents of the United States, one right after the other. Then the fourth person that we need to talk about, who was a Federalist at one point and then a Democratic Republican at another point, is Aaron Burr. So Aaron Burr is a New York attorney. He really is a founding father. I don't know if today in history people consider him a founding father. He's really known more for shooting Alexander Hamilton in a duel. He was initially a Federalist and then switched to Democratic Republican, but not because of his views, because of his opportunity that he sees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and you may be wondering, Royfield, why do we talk about James Monroe? Because he's not really president for a long time. But he becomes, at this time, he's the governor of Virginia, which becomes very important later in our story.
Right.
Okay. All right. So we have the setup. You did kind of briefly mention this, but there's going to be somewhat of a quirk in this election as to how it all kind of plays out. But back in 1800, we don't have anything like a universal franchise. Could you tell us who was eligible to vote in 1800 and how exactly those electoral college seats are going to be apportioned via the states?
So going back, because things were starting to loosen up by 1800, there was a land requirement. So you had to be a landholder to vote.
You also had to be white and male.
Fair. Yes. Which we'll get to in a second. 1% of the population voted in 1796. And Americans today think of our country as a democracy, and we're not. We're a republic. We looked at our country as 13 interests that would pool together as they made sense. And there was so much more emphasis on the states having sovereignty on how they elected their president. So in 1787, the three-fifth compromise is agreed to in Congress. So the Southerners said, you know what, we don't want these slaves to have their rights, but I'll be damned if I'm not going to get my electoral votes, you know, because of this. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So in 1796, in Adams' election, the black vote didn't matter at all. In 1800, there's, I think, 11 additional electoral votes out there because of the compromise, the three-fifth compromise.
Yes. So the three-fifths compromise basically counted black slaves as three-fifths of a person in counting population for each state to determine how many electoral votes each state gets.
Yeah.
So, for example, Virginia and Massachusetts have the same population of white citizens. And Virginia also has about one-third slave population. So as a result of the three-fifths compromise, the two states that had the same number of electorals now, Massachusetts has 16 and Virginia has 21.
Yeah. So it's a big swing.
So it's the black vote, not that the black slaves are voting, but they're counted towards those electoral counts.
Yeah. And then so what also kind of so there again, we have this idealistic vision of what our electors should be doing, but the pre-election posturing really starts happening on a state level. So 10 of the states appoint electors by their state legislatures, right? So the state legislatures are voted in by the average, you know, the common voter, and then the state legislatures pick the electors. It's not even done at the polls, right?
I think it's actually 11.
10 or 11. We'll firm that up.
Yeah.
So Kentucky, Maryland, and North Carolina had districts and divided up their votes accordingly. Rhode Island and Virginia were chosen by the voters, and Georgia, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire changed election laws because they looked at their local politics and said, you know what, it's more advantageous for the Republican Party to, you know, do winner take all, because famously New York had a big move to the Republican, a Democrat Republican Party, and Aaron Burr was a big part of it. And they figured, we're at a tipping point where we have a majority. Let's go to the state house and do winner take all. And they did the same thing in Virginia. James Monroe famously did so in Virginia to a winner take all approach, and that hurt Adams gratefully. So you in the actual election. So you have all this pre-election posturing happens in Pennsylvania as well. Massachusetts happens as well, which actually kind of blew up in the Federalists' face because they had because the Republicans actually took a couple seats.
Right.
But you have all this, and we don't have Twitter, we don't have CNN back then. So these guys were kind of putting their fingers up in the air and corresponding with each other over, you know, at the pace of horseback to try to do this. So this is all kind of happening in advance.
The Gleaner, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Monday, December 8th, 1800. Pennsylvania Legislature. The Legislature of Pennsylvania have at length agree to the appointment of electors. Their conditions: each house to nominate 8 candidates, out of which 15 electors are to be chosen. Consequently, 8 will be Republican and 7 federal.
Okay, and then could you just explain to us before we get into how exactly the various candidates went about electioneering, tell us exactly how electors could actually vote for the president and vice president. How did that process actually work back then?
Well, they didn't vote for president and vice president. So they had 2 votes and both were for president. And the thought process behind this were the politicians were supposed to be above party again. The thought process behind this, very in a very naive sense, was that there would be favorite sons locally. Like, so there, people would know their local favorite candidates, right? And they would vote for, they would vote one presidential vote for that. So if it was just, or if we're in a world where it's just C.C. Pinckney and John Adams, you would have the South Carolinians would vote for C.C. Pinckney, but they'd also vote for Adams.
Yes. Right. So, I mean, the intent was that those 2 votes were cast,
mm-hmm.
and the candidate with the most electoral votes obviously becomes president,
mm-hmm.
and the second place finisher becomes vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that there weren't tickets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there really weren't, but there were 2 Democratic Republicans running and 2 Federalists running.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought was, you know, if the country goes Federalist, then you've got a Federalist VP and president.
That's the way it's supposed to go.
Correct.
And what ends up happening is and you look at the election before where Adams really wins by 1 electoral vote. That's because party discipline starts needing to happen. And we'll get into the election of 1800. But if everyone votes for Adams and Pinckney equally, well, you have a tie and you have a crisis. You go to the House of Representatives. So you needed to coordinate with other states to have what's called a throwaway vote, where one of the electors will vote for some random guy, so you don't have the tie. The Federalists were good at this. Unfortunately for our story, the Democratic Republicans were not.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Okay. All right. So it's the election of 1800. I'm presuming that there were no battle buses, there was no jetting around the United States, and that the candidates didn't really travel outside of their own state even. How exactly did they electioneer?
If Thomas Jefferson wins, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed. The soil will be soaked with blood and the nation black with crimes. Are you prepared to see your dwellings in flames, female chastity violated, children writhing on a pike?
I'm John Adams, and I approve this message because Jefferson is the son of a half-breed Indian squaw raised on hoe cakes, and Hamilton is a Creole bastard brat of a Scotch peddler.
Before the parties became very blatantly obvious, there was a lot of quote-unquote summits, where I think there was one where Jefferson went upstate New York to quote-unquote take in the trees, but it was actually a Democratic-Republican meeting. A lot of correspondence by mail.
Yeah, and I mean, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, that there's these political rags. That's what the public is seeing, right? Because you aren't traveling all over. You're seeing what these rags are saying about each of the other candidates. And in this election, it is dirty politicking. I mean, by the time the election occurred, I'm surprised anyone wanted to vote for either party or any of the candidates, because based on those rags, America was going to fall apart.
Well, and you got to also remember, these guys didn't have to necessarily write under their own name. These guys would ghostwrite articles, and it became obvious to a lot of them who it was. But information, you know, didn't flow fast. But in the major metropolitan areas, you'd have multiple rags, and there was just no accountability for what they had to say.
So, but it's fair to say, though, that at that time, if you were running to be president, you couldn't seem to be actively campaigning. That was seen
as... Oh, absolutely.
As...
Correct. Yeah. Right. Jefferson would always say, I'm going to retire to Monticello. And in 1796, he probably would have won the presidency if he actually campaigned a little harder than he did. But, you know, these guys had to have... It was very much a Roman...
They were gentlemen.
Yeah, they were gentlemen. So yeah. You don't actively campaign.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we actually get up to the vote in late October all the way through November, were there any key issues specifically that they were campaigning on, as opposed to just against each other, just kind of throw dirt at each other? What were those campaign issues of that election?
Well, so the key ones, we got into the alien and sedition, which I think is the biggest one.
And did they want to just get that repealed by then?
Well, so it was scheduled to sunset in 1801. One of them was actually the Alien Acts is still in effect today, albeit changed somewhat. But they were supposed to sunset in 1801. Another issue, I mentioned the taxes to fund the quasi-war. So we're used to April 15th being a big deal here, and you know, a lot being taken out of our paycheck. This is prior to the national income tax. I mean, we're having whiskey rebellions. We're having Shays rebellions over taxes, over funding issues, things like that. And any tax, especially to raise a standing army and a navy and this is, again, a very Federalist thing.
It is. You know, and to piggyback on that, I mean, that's a great point. There's an issue of whether we have a standing army and navy versus disbanding it. There's a question about whether we have a central bank that's assuming the debt of these of our states from the Revolution.
Absolutely, yeah. Jefferson looked at, and Democratic Republicans looked at a centralized bank, and I can kind of see how and why that they did that, because you know, British Empire, you know, a very mercantilistic thought, was very much at the root of what kind of chapped the colonists' hide. And Hamilton and Adams battled over this bitterly, and Adams really took George Washington to heart, keeping out of foreign conflicts. But Hamilton started working against Adams, and even had George Washington co-opt him, and you know, worked against Adams almost as much as Jefferson over this issue. And again, as I mentioned, ironically, the Democratic Republicans didn't want to have a standing army or navy, but they wanted us to help France out. Right. But not pay back our war loans. I mean, it's just very contradictory. British favoritism is kind of an extension of that. You know, we're still kind of in the hangover from the Revolution. Adams is very, very much on the Federalist train at this point. I think he was a great centrist. I think he just was very cantankerous and unlikable in a lot of ways. But I think he was really trying to toe the line well. on the Jefferson side, the big issue with him was he was kind of a deist, and that's a different podcast, but he was kind of looked at as anti-religious, and the Federalists painted him as atheist.
Yeah, you know, and just to back what you were saying about Adams, you know, I would say that Adams actually moved more towards the center to try to appeal to the entire country, but at the same time, his ally Hamilton was really a high Federalist and believed in the Federalist views, and Adams' move to the center really pissed at Hamilton off. I mean, they had their personal issues, obviously, but Hamilton started to try to actually get a different person elected as president.
C.C. Pinckney.
Yep, C.C. Yeah. Pinckney, exactly. And what happened was that it kind of backfired.
There's actually a modernized election commercial style where they take verbatim what these guys said in these newspapers, mm-hmm. and it's hysterical and it's terrible.
John Adams is a blind, bald, crippled, toothless man who wants to start a war with France. While he's not busy importing mistresses from Europe, he's trying to marry one of his sons to a daughter of King George. Haven't we had enough monarchy in America?
I'm Thomas Jefferson, and I approve this message because John Adams is a hideous, hermaphroditical character with neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman.
But the real breaking point happens when Adams decides that he is not going to raise the army to fight France. And he said, quote unquote, screaming. And I think HBO does a really good job of this, and John Adams dramatizing the scene.
That we are as likely to find a French army on these shores as we are on the moon. You dream of empire, Mr. Hamilton.
You question my loyalty, sir.
Oh, no, Mr. Hamilton, I question your sanity. Now, either you are stark raving mad, or I am. Good day, sir.
And Hamilton was done with him at this point.
So back in 1800, you know, there is no telephone. There's not even a telegraph. How exactly did leading figures of the time actually exchange ideas? How's the cut and thrust of political debate and how were ideas formed and argued against in that period in American history?
Almost everything was done via letter between the candidates, between the political leaders of the country. And I mean, a lot of our history that we see now, the history we know is from those letters.
Yeah, and you have to think of logistics back at that point. So today, the president's full-time in Washington, D.C. Back then, these guys would have legislative sessions, and Adams would retire to Peacefield, which was his home in Massachusetts. And he would get his correspondence brought up to him by Ryder. And it was really tough for him to keep his finger on the pulse a lot of times because he would, quote unquote, the gentlemanly way of putting it was, I will remove myself to Peacefield. I will remove myself to Monticello. And for sometimes it was a really good reason. Like there was yellow fever in the Capitol and it was not a really great time to be there. But these guys would have a legislative session. And John Adams was just really in love with Abigail. She was his force and his rock, and she kept him grounded. So he would a lot of times spend the summers up there. And so there, you cannot put a price on how much this letter writing helped. And it really does help us from a modern perspective, especially afterwards when Adams and Jefferson start writing letters after they reconcile. I mean, it's amazing right. How the value is from a historical perspective that these things are.
So it's 1800 and you've described America of the time in terms of the feel, the issues of the time. But what exactly was America in terms of its states and territories back then? And even where was the capital? Because it's not in Washington, D.C. back then.
By this point, we would have added Vermont, Kentucky, and Tennessee from the original colonies. The capital is in Philadelphia, and as part one of the compromises that actually got the Constitution ratified was the fact that the capital was in New York, and that made a lot of the southern states very uneasy because New York was the financial capital of the United States,
and you don't want to have the political capital up there. So a deal had been struck that a new district, the District of Columbia, would actually be constructed, and it was starting to be under construction during Adams' presidency. He actually moves from Philadelphia to become the first resident of the White House.
And that, I mean, that piece of land, it's worth noting, is really in the middle of the country. It's a piece of Maryland and a piece of Virginia.
Adams, during his only term, the District of Columbia is completed, and him and Abigail become the first residents of the capital of Washington, D.C.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So America in 1800 is the eastern seaboard with Kentucky and Tennessee. What does the rest of the future United States of America look like back then?
We've thrown off the yoke of quote-unquote British tyranny, right? But there's still a lot of empire.
Benevolent rule, sir. Benevolent rule.
Benevolent rule, yes. You're correct, correct. We still have the, in French, although they're a republic, they have a lot of land holdings. The Louisiana Purchase is not part of the United States yet. So when you get to the Mississippi, it's French. And then, right. and then a very kind of...
Which really covers, I mean, the middle of America.
It does.
From New Orleans to the Canadian border.
And then when you get to Colorado, which is where we are right now, it changes over to a Spanish possession. So you have everything. So you have British Canada, and then it runs down to where we think of Washington being today. And then Northern California, kind of that's where the Spanish holdings start. And so you have the Spanish Empire and you have the French Republic basically taking everything west of the Mississippi. And then you have Spanish Florida. So we're not even – so Georgia is where the southern terminus of the United States is of that point.
So before we go on to the results, let's go into a little bit of detail about actually the mechanics of the states and actually how they're going to vote. Tell us about those mechanics, please.
Sure. So as we mentioned, there's 16 states at this point. Within those 16 states, there's 134 electoral votes that will decide who the president is. Those electorals are part of the Electoral College. And Adam, you touched on this before, but 11 of the states choose their Electoral College from the state legislature. So there's really no input from the population itself, except for the election of that legislature. The other five are done by popular vote. Those electorals then, as we mentioned, will cast two votes. The idea being the candidate with the most votes will be president, and the candidate with the second amount will be vice president.
And they don't have a standard election. So again, the thing is you have the states are holding jealously onto their power to do things the way they want. So voting takes place over months, right? And there's rumors and of what's happening down in South Carolina and what's happening in Rhode Island and things like that. And so it's not just, okay, it's the first Tuesday in November. Let's tune into CNN. This is happening over a long period of time. So all these, you got to think of, again, back to the letter writing, all the correspondence, all the machinations locally, and you have delegations internally. So not everyone's on the same page. From that perspective, in their own state. So there's a lot of it's a very drawn out election process. Because of the way that of the times. B, because of the logistics of the times. And C, because the states are so jealously holding on to the way that they do it. And D, because we're a republic. Again, we got to go back to the fact that we are not a democracy. This is not a direct election. This is. But we looked at the French Revolution as rabble, democracy as a rabble, unorganized, ungentlemanly. We looked at ourselves as above that. So part of that is control over it not allowing the normal, average citizen to have as much say as we like to think our American dream is. Is that a good way of putting it, or is it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, I think one more thing that's important as a setup for the actual election is if no candidate has a majority selected, then the selection of the president goes to the House of Representatives.
Yes, yes. Which at this point is the midterm elections or the elections have happened and the House is going to change to Democrat-Republican majority.
But
what
under the rules of the Constitution, if it goes to the House, it has to go to the House as constituted during the year of the election, which is heavily federalist, and sets up what the story we're going to get into in a minute.
How exactly did those 4% of Americans actually go and vote in that election? Where did they turn up to cast their ballots?
Well, some of them in the 11 states, Matt thinks it's 11, I think it's 10, but they actually didn't. So the state legislatures appointed the electors. So they were represented by virtue of the fact that they had voted for their state legislatures. And, you know, but there were like Rhode Island and Virginia were chosen by the voters. There was a lot of caucusing at this time too, Royfield. So we think of the ballot box. There's a lot of caucuses, which are kind of open debates where you take straw polls and you come to consensus, you debate.
Right.
And then there's Kentucky, Maryland, and North Carolina where people voted up and voted by districts. But there was an amalgamation of voting, caucusing, things like that. But again, every state wanted to be able to do it their own way. And that's the way it is today, actually. That's why we have caucus states and we have, primary mm-hmm. election states.
The vote takes place. Tell us about the results.
We have to separate this into two distinct elections, right? So the first one is between Adams and Jefferson. And opinion polls, I mean, the popular vote was pretty slanted towards
Republicans.
Yeah, exactly. And the actual election was, I think he lost by, what was the electoral tally?
Adams got 65 votes and Thomas Jefferson got 73 votes.
Which makes it sound a lot closer than it was. There's a lot of states like New York that had hit a tipping point. Pennsylvania did as well. Those were Federalist strongholds before. And for instance, this is the first time New York had voted for Democrat Republicans. Even this is the last time that Vermont voted for the Federalists. This is going to be the last time we're ever going to see a Federalist president. The actual election was pretty much going to go Jefferson. I mean, the writing was on the wall. Adams even knew. Adams fought pretty hard early on. He wanted it. And I think about towards the end of his presidency, he was just kind of resigned to the fact that this was going to be his fate. But again, we got to go. The real story here happens with party discipline, where, again, going back to what the Federalists stuck to their guns and they voted for Adams and Pinckney. But they corresponded via letter again, and they decided that one of the electors in Rhode Island would have a throwaway vote. And he voted for John Jay. And again, the point of that was that you would not have a tie between Adams and Pinckney and then have to go to the House of Representatives. Now, did the Democratic Republicans have this? They had their slate their party platform. Their candidates were Jefferson as president and Aaron Burr as vice president.
Yes.
And there was no Burr is, let's be nice, he's a weasel, right? And
very much an opportunist.
Yeah, and he was brought in because he was a New York Democrat Republican, and he's a Northern Democratic Republican. But he knew his place. He knew where he was supposed to be. He corresponded with Jefferson and proclaimed his loyalty. But guess what? The Democratic Republicans did not have a quote-unquote party discipline and had their own – did not throw away a vote.
Correct. So it was a tie.
73-73.
Yep.
So you had Adams coming in a distant third, and because Aaron Burr and because the Democratic Republicans didn't have a throwaway vote, we have a constitutional crisis. Well, not really, because it's spelled out, but it's a train wreck.
Right. So the vote now heads to the House of Representatives.
Exactly. Yeah.
The old House of Representatives.
Exactly.
Which is a Federalist House.
Mr. President. You honor me prematurely, sir. The House is still in deadlock.
Oh, God grant they may soon reach a decision.
A word from you would
end the uncertainty. That is for the Congress to decide. I have no business in that matter.
If the Federalist conspirators are allowed to defeat this election, there will be resistance by force, and the consequences could be incalculable.
The outcome of this election is within your power. You have only to honor the national debt, of which the Federalists hold dear, and the government will instantly be in your hands.
I will not enter office, but in perfect freedom to follow the dictates of my own judgment.
And in that case, events must take their own course.
And if you think about it, if you're thinking of this as a Federalist congressman, you're like, okay, clearly Adams is done. He's not. We can't win this for. We can't win the election for Adams because our choices are now Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson. And you have to go back to how fast information was traveling at this point. You have Burr sitting in one state, and you have Jefferson sitting in a different state. And Burr doesn't really know what's going on at this point, and they're corresponding. Jefferson's constantly reaching out to Burr saying, "We're good, right? We're good, yeah. right?"
And to that point, I mean, the election's in November mm-hmm. of 1800. The House of Representatives doesn't get together and choose a president until February of 1801.
Yeah.
So that's 5 months.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. yeah. So Burr is, you know, he's kind of just sitting, corresponding with Jefferson saying, yes, I'm great with you, you know, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. And then the Weasley part of him kicks in. And he decides that, hey, you know, I may be able to, you know, I may be able to take this thing. And the reason he does this really is because the Federalists look at this as we're not going to get Adams in there, but we can get a deal. You know, there are things on the table that they stood to lose. They stood to lose the central bank, the standing army. They had federal appointees that they wanted to keep in place. And so the Federalists start corresponding with both of them. With Jefferson, with Burr, and Burr and Jefferson start corresponding with each other, and Burr starts getting more brazen and saying things. Well, I might be vice president if you give me, you know, the initiative in foreign policy, or the authority. Basically, he wants to really expand the power of the vice presidency. And Jefferson is just kind of like, dude, come on, man, you were cool with your role a while ago. And the Federalists are fully on board with it initially with trying to muck things up because Thomas Jefferson was the enemy of the Federalist cause.
Right. And I mean, Alexander Hamilton, even though he is not on the ticket and his political career is pretty much dead, he's still respected as the leader of the Federalist Party, the High Federalists at this point. And a lot of that activity happening in the background is from Hamilton.
Yeah. And it's funny because out of all the everyone in the story pretty much hates Alexander Hamilton except for Burr. Him and even 5 days before he shoots him, they're at a dinner party together and Burr gives him a toast.
Absolutely.
And it's hysterical. But Hamilton realizes the gig is up. And once he realizes the gig is up, he looks at Burr, who he knows well. So Hamilton starts writing to the electors in favor of Jefferson versus Burr, saying he'd rather support a man who has the wrong convictions than none at all.
Yeah. So Hamilton decides that he's going to swing his support to Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
But he wants to make sure he gets something out of it.
Yeah. Their first vote goes 8 for Jefferson, 6 for Burr, and 2 no result.
And that vote is the state.
Yeah.
The state represents.
Yeah, exactly. So each state gets one vote. So and that vote is concocted out of the delegation's vote. So, for instance, in Maryland, you have a no result because you have 8 total delegates, and which are members of the House of Representatives. So, Maryland had 8 representatives. They tied 4-4. So, there's no result there. And so, they needed 9 to elect. They were deadlocked for the first 35
Correct.
Votes. And again, this is happening over
5 months. Votes.
Over 5 months.
Right.
Well, no, the voting didn't happen over 5 months.
No, the voting happened over 3 days.
Yeah, yeah, well, I think.
But 35 votes, and it's tied 35 times.
Yeah, but even before the votes are happening, all the politicking got us to this point where we're deadlocked out of the gate. And Jefferson and Burr are going back and forth. They try to get John Adams involved. Jefferson famously makes a visit to John Adams and says, you know, just a word from you would really help me out here. And Adams says, look, I'm not going to endorse you, but if you are willing to make a deal on keeping the Navy and, you know, keeping the bank, I think you'd be in good shape.
And not firing Federalists who are working
exactly.
for the government.
Exactly.
Currently.
I've seen multiple reports on this. And in my personal opinion, there's a lot of initial reports that said Burr wasn't going to make a deal. And my personal opinion is that Burr was trying to make a deal as well. it was a situation where people respected Thomas Jefferson more, but the Federalist House was corresponding with both, but they really wanted Jefferson to end up with the presidency and use Burr as a way to whip Jefferson into a better posture.
So, I mean, as a result, Hamilton tells his Federalist friends to vote for Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
Because of those promises. Now, they don't necessarily vote for Thomas Jefferson. They just don't vote.
Yeah. So at this point, the drama happens. And the first state is Maryland, which is split 4-4, which means no result. The same is for Vermont, which is 1-1. Delaware's for Burr, but only has one representative. South Carolina has selected 3-1 in favor of Burr. And with the goings back and forth, and Thomas Jefferson, I mean, Hamilton has done some correspondence, but Jefferson really seals the deal when he agrees that he's not going to change those things. And Maryland was tied. All four Burr votes changed to no decision. So Jefferson gets Maryland's vote. And Vermont's one Burr vote goes undecided, and Jefferson gets Vermont's vote. And Delaware and South Carolina can't quite stomach completely flipping, but switch to no decision, taking both away from Burr. So it goes from 8-6-2 to 10-4-2, and Jefferson is elected.
Right, so we now have our new president. What are the immediate repercussions of Thomas Jefferson donning high office?
So one thing, I guess a consequence, not necessarily a consequence, but a precedence, is when Thomas Jefferson takes over, there is a peaceful transfer of power. Now, this was the revolution of 1800. I mean, this was a dirty election. There were a lot of things said, and it had very polarizing effects on the country and these parties. But after the election was done, a peaceful transfer of power was done from the Federalists to the Democratic Republicans. And that actually set a precedence that continues today.
And I think you have to give them all pats on the back, given how high the stakes were at the time. I mean, we have some issues today, but at this point, do we have a Navy? Do we have a central bank? You know, things like that. And there were some diabolical differences.
And Thomas Jefferson kept his promises to Hamilton.
Yeah,
like you said.
Yeah.
He kept the bank. He kept a standing navy.
Yeah.
Weekly Rally Register, 3rd March, 1801, Tuesday. To which the president-elect was pleased to make the following reply. I receive, gentlemen, with profound thankfulness, this testimony of confidence from the great representative council of our nation. It fills up the measure of that grateful satisfaction which had already been derived from the suffrages of my fellow citizens themselves, designating me as one of those to whom they were willing to commit this charge, the most important of all others to them. In deciding between the candidates whom their equal vote presented to your choice, I am sensible that age has been respected rather than more active and useful qualifications. I know the difficulties of the station to which I am called, and feel and acknowledge my incompetence to them. But whatsoever of understanding, whatsoever of diligence, whatsoever of justice, or of affectionate concern for the happiness of man, it has pleased Providence to place within the compass of my faculties, shall be called forth for the discharge of the duties confided to me, and for procuring to my fellow citizens all the benefits which our Constitution has placed under the guardianship of the general government.
Adams decided that he was not going to go to Thomas Jefferson's inauguration. A lot of that is a lot of people saying a lot of people make that out to him taking his ball and going home. He catches the 4 a.m. stagecoach out on inauguration day and goes back to Peacefield. I think part of him didn't want to see Jefferson inaugurated, but so his son had also recently died from alcoholism, and I think he was just kind of done and he wanted to go home. So I think it was 50-50, and a lot of sources I've read have indicated that he wasn't as – I mean, you had Jefferson visiting him before and kind of talking things through with him. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was that antagonistic towards Jefferson at that point, but I think he just kind of was done with it.
You know, the other big outcome of this was a new amendment, the 12th Amendment, that basically corrected the electoral issue.
Yeah.
And changed it from 2 votes to 1 vote. So you vote for a president.
And a vice president.
And a vice president together.
Well, and funny, going back to Inauguration Day before we move on to that, this was America fell in love with Thomas Jefferson's pen, right? Mm-hmm. They saw his writings, everything from the Declaration of Independence. Right. But he was a horrific...
Ferocious.
He was an absolutely atrocious speaker. And John Marshall ends up administering the oath of office to Jefferson's back. And Jefferson's turned away from him.
Right.
And Jefferson, I don't know, but it's something else. But Jefferson ends up being very meek, and everyone kind of looks at each other afterwards like, this guy can barely talk in public.
You know, and you take a look at that, his inauguration speech on mm-hmm. paper now, and it looks good. Because, he's like you said, he had magic with the pen, but his delivery was terrible.
Yeah, exactly.
That being said, he did become one of the best presidents we've had.
Friends and fellow citizens, called upon to undertake the duties of the first executive office of our country, I avail myself of the presence of that portion of my fellow citizens which is here assembled to express my grateful thanks for the favor with which they have been pleased to look toward me, to declare a sincere consciousness that the task is above my talents, and that I approach it with those anxious and awful presentiments which the greatness of the charge and the weakness of my powers so justly inspire. A rising nation, spread over a wide and fruitful land, traversing all the seas with the rich productions of their industry, engaged in commerce with nations who feel power and forget right, advancing rapidly to destinies beyond the reach of mortal eye, when I contemplate these transcendent objects and see the honor, the happiness, and the hopes of this beloved country committed to the issue and auspices of this day, I shrink from the contemplation and humble myself before the magnitude of the undertaking.
The Federalist Party is dead. The Democrat Republicans take every election until 1828, when Andrew Jackson wins as a Democrat. The party splits off at that point. There was the things like the corrupt bargain in the previous election with right. John Quincy. But so you mentioned the 12th Amendment. That was a big deal. We won't have that again. He keeps the bank. Napoleon is fighting a war in – I think it was against the Second Coalition at this point, but I'm not sure. He's sick of having to maintain a colony in the United States and comes to Jefferson and says – well – not to Jefferson, but to the United States, and offers to sell the land to us. And Jefferson, this would have been a move that Jefferson himself, during Washington's administration and during Adams' administration, he would have raised his ire and called this tyranny, monarchism. But he basically, I give him a lot of credit for this because he saw a great deal, mm-hmm. and he goes forward with it. Interestingly enough, he parcels the land out and funds his first two terms plus Madison's term with the proceeds from parceling out the land of the Louisiana Purchase. So very fiscally prudent.
The purchase doubles the size of the United States.
Yeah.
So we have Jefferson as president, and he's going to go and double the size of the United States. What happens to the other principal actors in the election of 1800 afterwards?
I guess I'll take Adams. Adams retires to Peacefield. He kind of becomes a farmer, and he is actually the only one who ends up with money. And dies with money.
Yeah,
his Peacefield.
I mean, Thomas Jefferson lives the lifestyle of a king.
He must have been fun to party with.
Yep.
He must have been a lot of fun to party with. So these guys are. It's not super enmity, but they really their friendship's broken. I mean, they were dear friends early during the Revolution and up to their time in politics together. In 1812, they reconcile and start writing letters to each other. Jefferson's out of office at this point, and through a friend, someone suggests to Adams that he reach out to Jefferson and start a correspondence, and they do. And in 1812, they start writing letters back and forth to each other. And Adams basically, the quote was, "We need to explain ourselves to each other." And they do. All the way up to 1826, they both, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
They both die on July 4th, 1826.
The 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence.
You can't make this stuff up.
Right.
Thomas Jefferson dies first in the morning. And Adams dies in the evening around 6 o'clock, and his last words were, "Thomas Jefferson survives," which obviously he would have had no way of knowing, but
should have just emailed him.
Yeah, exactly. But in the interim, John Adams had also had his son John Quincy Adams, who might have been one of the best statesmen ever. I mean, he served in Russia, and multiple different posts. And, he got to see his son be the president of the United States as well. And then, George Washington had faded out. I mean, after his second term, he had kind of in a ceremonial.
Retired.
Yeah. In a ceremonial capacity, agreed to be the commander in chief of the war should the quasi war actually turn into a shooting war with France. But that would have really been Alexander Hamilton at the head of the army with George Washington as a figurehead. He had died pretty shortly after his term ended. James Madison obviously becomes president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, we touched on Thomas Jefferson, but he becomes the third president. He has two terms. Again, he's known as one of the best presidents we've had. He is, once his terms are up, he retires, truly retires, mm-hmm. to Montecito, or Monticello, sorry.
Montecito, isn't that a fish taco place in California?
Once his terms are up, he permanently retires to Monticello and begins the life of a retired president. Living a full life, living a extravagant life, not necessarily having the means to live that life.
Right, right.
So he dies a poor man in a giant mansion. Yeah. Is the way you could say it.
James Monroe becomes president as well.
The fifth president.
And gives us the Monroe Doctrine. Keep out of our hemisphere, foreign empires. Now we get to the juicy stuff. Alexander Hamilton in 1804. Again, he's in New York. So Alexander Hamilton is still a big presence in the Federalist cause. He's writing a lot of pamphlets, and he really just can't help himself. What a lot of people don't know about him is that he died with a duel with Burr, but I think that was his 11th duel. And it's important to go into dueling a little bit at this point. A duel is basically, a lot of them are there's someone has insulted another challenges them to a duel. You go to a remote place across a river. In this case, it was the key duel was across the Hudson in New Jersey. And you have the opportunity to apologize. And if no apologies happen, then a lot of times you'll have what's called give up your first shot, which is you'll shoot in the air instead of shooting at your opponent. And then you can still say, do you really want to apologize? And most of the duels are resolved that way. But Hamilton and Burr have a falling out, and they're both stubborn gentlemen. And there's a lot written about this, and we're not going to get into this now. This is a different podcast, but it's generally agreed that Hamilton shot first, close enough to Burr where he thought he was actually in danger. And so Burr was well within his rights to shoot it by the dueler's code and dueling was not legal in every state. So they had to cross the river to get to New Jersey because it was illegal in New York.
Of course it's legal in New Jersey.
Of course, hey, we got to do what you got to do.
Right.
So Burr was well within his rights to then shoot Hamilton, which he did. And Hamilton dies, I think, 3 or 4 days later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so Aaron Burr continues.
Oh, man, this guy's a hot mess.
Immediately after the duel, Aaron Burr fears that he's going to be arrested for killing Alexander Hamilton.
The Sprig of Liberty, 27 July, 1804, Friday. The accounts respecting the affair of Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, Esquires, are so contradictory that we cannot possibly determine which is correct. They all agree, however, that Mr. Hamilton was wounded and died of the wound. But as to the occasion of the duel, not two of them agree. Some say the intrigue at the presidential election. Others say a piece which was published at Albany and republished at New York, in which it was said Burr was a dangerous man. And it is further said, without reference to either, that the cause was political. Mr. Burr's second is said to be W.P. Van Ness, Esquire, Mr. Hamilton's Judge Pendleton, and Dr. Hossack, his physician.
He ends up going to trial for the murder of Alexander Hamilton. He is acquitted, so he doesn't go to jail, but his reputation is tarnished. He's really not welcome in America anymore.
Well, keep in mind, he's the vice president for Thomas Jefferson at this point. He came in, he officially came in second in the election.
That's a great point.
So he's Jefferson's vice president, and Jefferson has just so had it with this guy. And why did he get tried for treason? Yeah, so he basically had started speculating in land as far as Texas, and possibly dabbling in starting a republic. And as a sitting vice president, that's not the message you want to be sending, and it's illegal.
Right.
So Thomas Jefferson kind of has it, and Aaron Burr gets off and is really shamed. I mean, his republic, his political life is over at this point.
He flees to Europe, actually.
No, Chile.
Europe.
Really?
Yeah. He has relatives that live in Chile.
Oh.
He flees to Europe.
Okay.
To try to regain his fortunes.
Mm-hmm.
He's not very successful. He actually changes his last name, so he's more anonymous in Europe. He ends up marrying a rich widow who's 20 years younger than him. And when she realizes a couple years after they're married that he's spending all of her fortune and losing it, she divorces him quickly. So he really, after that, he really spends the rest of his life kind of in quiet solitude and dies a poor man.
Gentlemen, thank you for taking us through the election of 1800. But Matt, you're new to 10 American elections. Just for the sake of listeners, who the dickens are you?
Thanks, Rafael. I live in Colorado, here in the U.S. I am an IT professional, and in my spare time, I like to read Wikipedia, and Adam and I also do a random American Moments podcast that really covers anything from, like, Nintendo to...
Well, we did The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, and the next one's going to be about the Johnstown Flood in 1889. So we're going to be cutting that one hopefully next week. So definitely check it out if you haven't already.
Fantastic. And Adam, what have you been doing since we recorded Grant all those months ago?
Well, I, a lot of it's been American Moments. I've really learned to appreciate the amount of work it takes to edit a show. I don't know how you do this as much as you do it. But it's been great being on the show before with you, because it's really driven the style of American Moments, you know, with audio clips and things like that. And there's shows, as you know, like The Jungle, where there are no audio clips really that you can really bring to bear. But it just adds a lot of color, and the show's very similar in style. And I'm really having a lot of fun with it. Besides that, just trying to stay afloat.
Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, as I said before, thank you for taking us through the election of 1800. Dear listener, you can follow us on Twitter, where we are 10usp.com. If you want to follow us on Facebook and join our group of some 500-600 liker lurkers, you can do that by typing in 10 American presidents into Facebook. If you want to send me an email, you can. Quite simply, I'm Royfield, which is R-O-I-F-I-E-L-D @gmail.com. If you'd like to show your appreciation for our good works here, you can join us on Patreon and pledge a certain sum of money each time we do a podcast to help keep the servers afloat, so to speak. And then lastly, could you please send us a nice review on iTunes? That's the best way for all podcasts to get a little bit of traction in the Apple iTunes charts. That's been me, Roy Field, with new friend Matt and with old friend Adam at 10 American Elections, which is part of the 10 American Presidents series. See you all again next month for another show.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.